Whenever you're ready.
Okay. Here we go.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
We're on.
Blowing one pack of stocks and jocks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. A little late. Every red light in the world was found. S&P futures down 17. NASDAQ futures down 88. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
I'm good. The word of the day, or the phrase of the day, is master exothermic core mantle decoupling.
Wow.
We're going to start Thursday off right with full brain engagement.
Really?
You know what that means? I just read this. So the Earth, you know, has a liquid core that is highly magnetic, right?
Yep. Plus it's iron.
Yeah, it's hot. It's molten. And on this core sits, at some point, the mantle and the crust. There apparently is alignment between the mantle and the crust, between the core and the mantle and crust, that takes one of two forms. There's a magnetic alignment, which is generated by the Earth's magnetic field, in part caused by all that sloshing around down there with the liquid iron that generates a magnetic field that sets up our poles. So we have a magnetic North Pole, magnetic South Pole, and this provides a stable, synchronized basis for the core and the mantle to move together. But when the magnetic poles realign, which they do periodically, and we basically end up with a non-magnetic surface or non-magnetic orientation in the core, the poles disappear. And the theory is, the exothermic core mantle decoupling, is that the Earth's crust, when you don't have that magnetic alignment, because of the spin of the Earth, it realigns and restabilizes based on the spin, like gyroscopic momentum. What that means is that the Earth's crust basically detaches from the core and moves to align itself with a gyroscopic pole rather than a magnetic pole. And that translates into violent, rapid movement, synchronized movement, not like giant earthquakes and stuff, although I assume that happens, so you get some shaking, but it's not like the crust splits. The crust just slides over the top of the core. Now, this normally would create a certain amount of issues with movement. But the big problem is that you have gigantic amounts of surface water that has its own momentum and its own mass. And it's detached from the Earth's crust. It doesn't move necessarily with the Earth's crust. So when you have a violent shift of the Earth's crust, the water tends to stay in the same place, which means that when the crust moves laterally, the water comes violently up over the coast and floods the living daylights out of the place. And this supposedly, under this theory, this accounts for every major prehistoric culture that we know of has a flood narrative, whether it's Gilgamesh or Noah or the Mayans or whomever. But if they got a civilization where they were recording things, they have a flood narrative. And that flood narrative goes back to, I think the last time this happened was about 50,000 or 60,000 years ago. Maybe. Now, the most recent theory says that it happened sometime, that this realignment happened sometime shortly after the building of the pyramids, because they say they can identify a watermark on the pyramids at Giza.
But they also, they think it was because of rain. It looked like rain coming down, not water washing over.
Oh no, this would be tsunami type stuff. This would be the functional equivalent of you putting a bowl of water, a shallow bowl of water on a table, and then moving the bowl sideways suddenly.
But the dude who's done all his research, he's on YouTube on the Great Pyramid, and he's trying to rewrite history, saying it's like way older than anybody thinks.
Yeah.
Claims that the water marks on the Sphinx are from rain, so the area had to be rainy at the time they did it or something.
Well, the Sphinx, yeah. The Giza watermarks supposedly are part of this anyway.
Plus, it's all salt water. What could that hurt? God.
That's right. As if we didn't have enough to worry about.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know about you, I got the Rocky Mountains on one side of me and the Appalachians on the other. You're yeah. sitting next to a giant bowl of water.
Yeah, well, that's a problem.
Anyway, just something to get everybody in the Stocks and Jocks universe, get their brains working this morning. Well, to think about what?
I want to let you legal guys know, yet another terrific call by the justice system. Well, I won't call it the justice system, a judge. Evidently, some people sued. Did you hear the story? Buffalo Wild Wings, because the boneless wings are not wings. They're essentially hunks of chicken.
There's something else, right?
Well, legs. So the gets to court and they say, look, this is bad advertising. You're saying boneless wings, they're not wings. So somehow or another, it works its way through. And I don't know if Buffalo Wild Wings supported the judge for office or what, but the judge rules in favor of Buffalo Wild Wings with the idea that the term wings refers to a style of cooking and not a chicken body part. And I'm sitting there going, what is he talking about?
Okay.
Not even the attorneys on the show would come up with that argument, with that much of imagination, much less win.
All right. I haven't seen the case, and I haven't
read it either. It just was the news thing yesterday. But Buffalo Wild Wings did win, and the idea was, just because they say wings, it doesn't really refer to the body part of a chicken that is the wing.
Well, and of course, I haven't seen the opinion, and I haven't seen the briefs. But if in fact this is common knowledge, then and nobody cares, then. I mean, the restaurant's got a point.
Well, other thing in the vernacular, if you order wings, the order is 10 wings, you get 10 half a wing. You never get 10. 10 wings would, you know, a disjointed wing would mean you would get 20 pieces. You never do. You get 10. And that's been around since, you know, God knows when. And yet, that's wrong, obviously. You don't get 10 wings. You get 5.
Yeah. I'm sure that, you know, there's a whole subculture of food that I know absolutely nothing about, and well, there are many subcultures of food that I know nothing about, and this is one of them. I am not a wings person.
How could you not be a wing?
I don't go to restaurants that serve them.
Super Bowl Sunday, Jimmy, if you got a chance, look this up. I'm thinking something like 1.2 billion wings went down. Now maybe they're half wings.
I believe they're popular. It's just not something I eat. And you know, I mean, I don't go to those kinds of restaurants.
Bars.
I used to, I
Bars
think, but I don't anymore.
Well, if you go to, I get this thing from the Peoria Market. I won't go into it. It's a food place that I like to go once in a while because it's so blue collar. All the meat is out on a big, you know, you're in a cooler and you get to pick the meat out yourself. Anyway. But you'll see their flyer, and I think something like is it 20 pounds of wings is like $50 or something like that. 20 pounds of legs and thighs are like $12 or $15. It's absolutely amazing the premium that are on wings because of all these bars and restaurants that serve wings.
I mean it makes sense. But yeah, I mean, so my guess, My guess is that the lawsuit argument was, this is a term of art with respect to this particular dish.
Yeah, maybe.
Everybody knows boneless wings are not wings. There are other chicken parts. And accordingly, this isn't false advertising. It's not like, you know, Subway, which got sued because apparently at some point, if I remember this correctly, the footlong sandwiches they were serving were not quite 12 inches. They were like 10 and a half. And somebody, somebody brought a suit. I assume it was in California, which is where a lot of this craziness starts. But somebody brought a lawsuit, and the state court, I think, said, there's no argument. If you're advertising a foot-long sandwich, it better be a foot long. And this is not a term of art. You better have a 12-inch bun out there for this food to go on. So,
why does a quarter-pound hamburger be nowhere near a quarter-pound, they say, before cooking?
Right.
And the fine print tells you that, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did you ever...
The number is 1.25 billion wings were consumed during Super Bowl.
That's a lot. Did you hear that, Lou?
1.25 billion?
Yeah.
So that's a lot of chickens,
yeah.
Number one. I think the day of gluttony used to be, in the United States, used to be Thanksgiving. But I think that Super Bowl Sunday has now surpassed that.
I don't think there's any question, especially since the darn thing starts at noon.
Well, and you're eating terrible stuff. I mean, Thanksgiving at least has, turkey and vegetables and stuff like that. And in terms of calories, at Super Bowl Sunday, you're eating fat, monstrous carbohydrates, sugar, oil, pretty much.
Not to mention all kinds of alcohol.
Bad for you.
You're
slamming back a lot of calorie dense stuff.
Last Super Bowl, I think, about the fourth quarter, even though I was at a party, I drove back. I left in the fourth quarter and went through by a couple bars. They only had like 10, 15 people left. And they start at noon, for God's sake. I mean, if the game takes forever, the halftime takes forever. I mean, what is it? So we're talking about. We start at noon and we finish up at maybe 9 o'clock. So let's say 8.5, 9 hours wrapped around 12 minutes of action. Yikes.
Well, I hearken back again to something my father said before, like in the late 60s, I think, when the NFL was still not America's game. It was baseball. And he said, baseball is really kind of a great television sport, but it's not as well designed for TV as football. Because in baseball, you don't have a finite end. In football, you do. In football, you've got regular breaks in the action where you can insert commercials. You've got, lots of violence and all that other stuff. But he said mainly it's the pacing. He said, and if the NFL ever figures out how to get teamed up properly with television, he said it's going to be Katie bar the door.
Well, and, he's right.
10 years later, we were just talking about how TV just basically dominates how they do stuff in the NFL. There's a couple of things that are sort of boiling over here, and finally, after a number of us have been talking about this for a while, Iran is the situation with Iran is finally percolated up to the top of the food stack, and people are maybe will get sick of talking, or the mainstream press will maybe get sick of talking about Jeffrey Epstein.
I don't think they're going to get sick of that. I think it's going to continue to grow because it is catching fire on a million different levels.
Well, gentlemen, if you didn't hear,
yeah, they arrested Prince Andrew this morning.
Was arrested this morning. Not Prince yep. anymore. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was arrested.
Yep.
So that's one. He's one you got evidence for. I again hearken back to that thing we talked about a couple of weeks ago, Tom, with respect to these so-called victims of Epstein. And there are, one of the things that jumps out at you, that has jumped out at me, and specifically the women that they trotted out as quote-unquote victims at that hearing. Every one of those women that was at that hearing, and I think there were four or five of them had been supposedly trafficked. Every one of those women signed up with Epstein when they were over 21. Every one of them accepted money from him in exchange for whatever services they were required to provide. They didn't decide they were trafficked until at the earliest 2019. So draw your own conclusions from that. I go back to, with, you know, even the that young woman, although she's not young, was not young when she committed suicide, Guffrey?
Yeah.
I think that was her name. You know, who actually sort of sounded like this. She changed her story multiple times. All of these people have. And it's one of the reasons, I mean, I go back again to that assessment that we talked about from the prosecutor in 2007. These people are not credible. If we have to go to trial on this, these people are not credible. Now, they had access at that point to much of the material that we're seeing now.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Well, but it doesn't matter. You know, all it does from a prosecutor's perspective, if the witness is not credible, if the witness has told multiple stories, then it doesn't matter what the emails say. The emails just introduce further reasonable doubt into the case. And so it looks, I'm not going to get excited over this. This situation has demonstrates at the worst demonstrates what I've said and what you and I've talked about, which is there are a lot of messed up people who are willing to turn a blind eye within our elites to conduct that they shouldn't. But, you know, is this the end of the republic? No. However, we are about to start.
All kinds of other things going on that might be the end of the republic, but go ahead.
Well, we're about to start, or it looks like we're about to start, a major conflict with a second world nation that can inflict, and I mean, this is something that's been coming since 1979, and it represents the, I'm just sorry that Jimmy Carter is not around to see the end of this, or see this, because this is his fault. But this is a...
Couldn't have been either one of the Bushes or any Republican. It has to be Carter.
Carter's the guy that deposed the Shah.
Yep.
So this is... I lay the groundwork on this strictly right at his feet. And I don't... You know, he's the guy that created the problem.
Who put the Shah in there?
Pardon me?
How did the Shah get in there?
The Shah got in there with a combination of corporate pushes and incompetence on the part of the Iranian elected leadership, who was a communist, as it turns out. The CIA had maybe some interest in it, but not really any influence.
Well, how do you dismember any of the crap in the Middle East from the U.S. and Britain? We're the ones who caused all this stuff.
The Brits were heavily involved in that, or more involved than that than we were, to a much greater extent. But, you know, the Shah got in there, and well, I'm just saying, in terms of American national interest, the Shah was in there. He was somebody that was a stable factor in the region, and Carter and his people promoted a religious theocratic minority, and that's what the Sunni or a Shia Muslim element was.
But the Shah's regime was kind of falling apart anyway, wasn't it?
I'm sorry,
his regime was pretty much falling apart anyway, wasn't it?
Well, but you know, I think it would have stabilized it with something, whether it would have been democratic elections or something, as opposed to a coup, which we basically said, yeah, go ahead. I lay this on Carter and his feckless foreign policy.
Whatever happened had to come from within. Because he was here. He was parachuting in.
He was in Paris.
Oh, yeah. He was out, okay, he was out of Iran.
And yeah, and we helped move him in there. Because I think, because of, again, Carter's feckless foreign policy worldview, which proved to be 180 out on the Russians, or Soviets, 180 out on the Iranians, and 180 out on the Panamanians and Israel as well. Anyway, that we are about to go to war, or we are real close to going to war. I am not happy about the fact. I don't know what coordination is being done with Congress. I realize war powers gives the president 60 days to do what he thinks is necessary before Congress comes in, but I would really, really like to know that there's some coordination going on with Congress over this whole thing. I have to assume there is. I'm just unhappy that I don't know.
This dude is in deep trouble. I wouldn't put it past him to start a war.
Who's in deep trouble?
Trump.
He's not in deep trouble about what?
He's in deep trouble about everything.
He's not in deep trouble for anything.
He's very close.
To what? Yeah, oh, please. The walls are closing in.
Oh, can
I? That's been going on from day one. That's a CNN talking point.
No, it's not.
Just turn that off.
No, it's not. No, it's not. The man would do anything. The man has no business being there, Lou. I don't trust anything he says or does. You see the story yesterday about the Treasury guy? The Treasury people need to be disciplined because they come out and said, we're paying the tariffs. Everybody knows that.
I didn't follow that. I haven't seen that story. This is an area where if he wants messaging, he gets messaging. I'm more concerned about the fact that we are getting ready to launch a major assault.
Another one after we just nailed Venezuela.
We didn't. That wasn't a major assault. That was nothing like what's about to come down.
Why do we have to go blast Iran tomorrow? They're no good next state. They're falling apart inside.
They're not falling apart. They've massacred a bunch of their people, but they're not falling apart.
Okay. They're at least as bad a shape internally as they were when the Shah went out.
No. I don't think so. Now, for one thing, the people in charge are much more ruthless than the Shah's people were.
Oh, I would agree with that, yeah.
And so the estimates are they've killed
someone. You got religion on your side, Lou. You can be ruthless as hell, right? We've seen that through the ages.
The estimates. Well, you know, China, Tiananmen Square. They took that lesson to heart. The estimates are they've killed somewhere between 50,000 and 70,000 of their own people in these demonstrations. Our situation is our national interest here is, I think, relatively straightforward, but. This goes back to a point that I made 10 years ago. You know, in a situation that requires for consistent, clear messaging, and this one does, the guy we got in the White House is not that guy. And I'm sorry, I wish he was. But, you know, we got to, and I wish he would turn over the messaging that I think needs to happen on this to Vance and Rubio and other people, Bessette and other people in that cabinet who are very straightforward and can articulate.
But what exactly? Here,
why, here's why A, is, here's B.
Why does the average American want us to go to war with Iran? We just went to war with Iraq. How'd that work out?
Well, that's what I mean, Tom. I would really appreciate. I can articulate why we're going in there.
I can think of reasons, yeah. All right, so we go blast the crap out of them. We have no plans on having boots on the ground. What makes you think what ends up isn't worse than it is now?
Well, that's why that Venezuela article that we got from Kevin yesterday was so interesting. I'm going to assume that there is some thought process with respect to, okay, if we take down the theocracy, or if we destabilize the theocracy to such an extent that a popular revolution occurs, what do we end up with? I'm reasonably certain somebody's talking about that or thinking about that. And the question I think would come up is, so who do you kill? I'm perfectly happy to destroy and kill thousands of Iranian military people based on the casualties that they inflicted on us in the Iraq war. I'm perfectly happy for that to happen.
So this is a revenge thing?
Yes, absolutely revenge. That part of the world understands revenge really well.
The people we're killing aren't the people who killed our people.
It doesn't matter. I want, that should have been taken care of, 25 years ago. Those guys are gone. Okay, fine. Well, I'll take a substitute. But because that kind of message, that kind of pain, is something that they understand and that the Arab world understands.
We never inflict pain on the people who cause the pain. There's a problem there.
If you destroy the theocracy, that's inflicting pain on the people who caused it.
It's like firebombing Dresden when Dresden had no more chance of getting Hitler out of office than I did.
But if we destroy the theocracy, that's good enough.
We're gonna destroy Islam by killing these guys.
No, we're not. We're gonna destroy this particular variation of it, or that's the goal. So the theory I think is we're going to destabilize. We're basically going to remove the power element from the theocracy, from the mullahs, so that they can't order people into the streets to massacre people.
So we're not talking about going in and messing up their nuclear. Now we're gonna kill their leaders, all of Venezuela.
Oh, we'll take down their nuclear stuff.
We already did that, didn't we?
Not all of it. We're gonna take that down to zero. I suspect.
Well, we keep dancing around this. People on the show, the guys from the left and the right, and I'm going to flat out say it, Lou. The people from the right, okay, and you're one of them. Even if stuff looks suspicious, somehow there's a feeling that behind this, what I consider to be an absolute mess in the White House, there's a deep dark thinker somewhere that is. Has absolutely got this all figured out and is doing it all right. I don't see that at all, and I'm very bothers the hell out of me.
We have evidence of it in lots of places.
Tearing down an East Wing, putting the guy's name up all over the place.
No,
where exactly
down the East Wing? Tearing down the East Wing actually makes a lot of sense.
Okay, where exactly is the filter here? I don't see it.
Well, okay, so. The first.
I'd love to see
major,
it. By the way,
the major. Let me finish. Yeah. The major marker for this is Venezuela. That was a thoughtful, well planned out.
And where are we now?
And well contemplated. Well, I mean, we are in a situation where the leadership of Venezuela is welcoming American and European energy companies back in to redevelop its energy sector. They are allowing demonstrations for the release of political prisoners, something that would have been unthinkable 6 months ago. So Venezuela is stable. We've decapitated the leadership of that country and managed to turn it carefully towards eventually a state that, if not pro-U.S., is at least going to be neutral. We've removed a major source of foreign influence in our own hemisphere, and we're going to continue. So, I mean,
And we got Trump's buddy a whole bunch of oil.
But you asked me for some kind of thoughtful, contemplative.
I hope, Lou, I hope it works out.
There's one.
You know, I hope it works out. I mean, but I think somewhere along the line, the end doesn't justify the means sometimes.
But that's not what you said. You changed the target.
What I'm saying is, I don't.
You said you wanted some kind. You wanted to think that there's some kind of calm intelligence behind this, and I'm saying we have a pretty good evidence that there is.
But you also said
respect
it's not,
to that foreign
not,
policy
not,
movement.
But who is it?
I don't know. I assume it's Vance.
Isn't that a problem?
It's Rubio.
Isn't that a problem?
Wait a minute. All of a sudden, you're concerned about this after watching Joe Biden for 4 years? I'm sorry.
Biden is gone.
I'm sorry. But your criticism of this administration
is a new record. It took you this long to bring up
impeached.
Biden.
I mean, you asked for evidence. I gave you evidence. Then you said, well, who is it? And I said, now you want to know who it is. It's a collaboration between the president and his advisors.
Okay.
Which is kind of the way it's supposed to work.
I get that part.
As I said, I wish I had more evidence of collaboration with Congress on this Iran situation. I don't. I assume it's going on because I can't imagine the Republicans in Congress sitting back and letting something like this roll without involvement. I assume there's involvement. I assume there's conferrals, but you know, I don't see evidence of it. I don't have any evidence of it. It makes me nervous.
Where do you see the strike on the nuclear facilities? I mean, I can, in collaboration with our allies, I don't really want Iran to have a nuclear capability. Except everybody around them has it.
No, they don't.
Who doesn't?
Who else has it around them?
Let's see, Pakistan.
Who else Israel? Around them has a nuclear capability?
Russia, Pakistan, Israel. Name somebody who doesn't, for God's sake.
The people who are engaged in Iran's foreign policy, like the Saudis, the UAE, the only people that are bumping up against, and the Russia's not threatening Iran, it's just the other way around. You have a belligerent, bellicose state that has got, as I said, I don't have any problem articulating U.S. national interest in taking that government down. A bellicose state armed, or trying to get nuclear weapons, armed to the teeth, that has an apocalyptic worldview, and has been exporting terrorism throughout the world for the last 40 years, I don't have any problem with a move to take them down.
Well, okay, so does Russia.
So
does Russia. They've invaded a place.
Yeah, and Russia, and we're fighting, we're supporting the fight back.
All right, so I'm with you on all this stuff, except I'm not, when you talk about
the fact is Russia has nuclear weapons, and that changes the equation.
Okay, so we're back to the might makes right. Well,
no, we're back to the foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
All right.
We don't have to be consistent. We have it's a different situation with Russia.
Right, so what exactly are we talking about? We bombed the nuclear stuff. According to our man, totally effectively, we put them out of nuclear business for how many years did he say we did? Now it's how many months?
Whatever
later?
It was, but as I said, I haven't seen an intelligence report on that except the guy who I know who designed that program and oversaw that program said the holes in the ground look exactly like what you would expect if we hit an underground facility. We have no idea what was in there when we hit it.
Okay, so I mean, I'm just trying to play along here that we did that. Now all of a sudden, what now the next step is, if we could go and find them all in a room and kidnap the Ayatollah and his top 10 guys, Louis, you got a guy with you here, except not what happens afterward. I mean, it wasn't like we just didn't do that in Iraq. We took out a no good Nick, and that's been the worst thing we've ever done, for God's sake.
Yeah, it was a total, complete failure of analysis by the foreign policy establishment
war now against Iran, now what are we talking about? We're not talking about, I don't think we're boots on the ground, but somewhere above nailing a nuclear facility. How are you going to, what war is defined as what here?
Well, in this case, it's the mustering of a massive amount of air power along with our allies. And the first strikes, I assume, will be on their ballistic missile capabilities. See, part of the issue, again, I don't have any problem articulating this, and this is what the president should be doing, or his people should be doing. The Iranians have completely, you know, that we did destroy their nuclear research facilities and did some other stuff. And the Iranians, instead of saying, all right, we probably ought to rethink this whole thing, they doubled down. They built more missiles. They reinforced what parts of their nuclear capability and nuclear production facilities that were still around. They reinforced those. They scattered their research facilities and hid them.
Where are they getting the money for this?
Well, they're selling oil to Russia. They're selling oil to China and to India, where they were.
They got how many million people? They got a. I don't see how the place exists. Yeah, I don't understand how North Korea exists either.
We keep asking the same question about Russia. Short answer is they've got total control over the economy and they're willing to bankrupt it if that's what it takes. Although I don't think they are bankrupting it, if that's what it takes to support this military establishment. And so this is going to be a countrywide strike on launchers, on missile production facilities. That'll be in air defense. That'll be the first wave. And then I assume the second wave will be to go after their military internal security apparatus to try to prevent them from massacring more of their own people. And basically what I think the goal is to try to get the theocracy to run, to go to Russia and or whoever would take them and sit there and basically abdicate. And I think that's the goal. But again, we're not articulating any of this.
This has to go to Congress, and it's not going to.
Not initially. It doesn't have to go to Congress except for within 60 days.
This sounds like a war to me. Sounds like war to me.
Yeah, but the statute, the most restrictive statute, which is the War Powers Resolution, the most restrictive statute says the president can do this for 60 days and then Congress has to step in.
We could attack Canada for 60 days before. That's a long way from only Congress can declare war.
I mean, that's the statute, Tom. That's the most restrictive statute that we've got with respect to a limitation on president's war powers.
Okay, so we don't have a constitution anymore.
Well, the Constitution says declare war, but the
so
president
you just don't
every
war.
every president since Jefferson has recognized that there are circumstances where he's going to use military for U.S. military force that are short of war.
Right, this sounds like war to me.
I know it sounds like war to me too. It's pretty close. I'm if it's not, I want some indication that Congress is in the middle of this.
All right,
We don't have it yet, and I don't. Right as of right now, as of today, if you look at the press releases, a number of countries are telling people to get out of Lebanon, get out of Israel, get out of Iran.
By the way, when you say allies, who's left as an ally?
I'm sorry.
Who's left as an ally for us?
For us?
Yeah.
I mean, the Israelis.
Yeah, the Israelis, because he's the only guy who loves.
No, the Brits. I think the Brits have moved assets into that area, and maybe the French, but I don't. I mean, in terms of actually doing the attack, it'll probably be just us and Israel. Maybe some British help, but I think some French help, but the Saudis will help. Probably some of the Emirates, but again, that's something maybe that'll all be laid out for us when this happens. This thing could happen this weekend, and that's one of the reasons I'm nervous. I don't like to see our forces committed to combat like this. I don't without the basis. I think it's the right thing to do. I just. You know, I'm a process guy. I would prefer the process was cleaner.
Well, I don't think there's anybody, surely including me, that wouldn't rather see an Iran that's a hell of a lot different than it is now. I mean, it's now the question is, whose job is it to do it? And the question that somebody asked Rubio, which of course he couldn't answer, was if somehow or another we went off kilter and our president and our government was in somebody else's mind screwing up, showing up to kidnap our president, would we consider that war? And Rubio goes, well, that would never happen here because we're too strong. And the guy goes, I asked you a question. Would we consider it wrong, or would we consider the person who did it to be at war with us? And the answer is yes. Okay, so if it's a war, I think the Constitution is fairly adamant that only Congress can declare war.
Yeah, but it again, no president from the dawn of the country has taken that as a limitation on using military force short of war.
That doesn't mean that everybody gets to up the ante to the point where anybody looking at it and go, boy, sure looks like war to me.
Well, you know, the short answer is Congress can stop this if it wants to.
We're prepared. What you're talking about, we're going to drop probably more ordnance on these guys on the weekend than we did on Germany total in 4 years.
No, not quite that much.
But it's going to be. It's more strategic, so it essentially is the same amount of damage.
It'll certainly be better aimed.
Okay, so all right. So to me, that's war. I'm just a dummy from the South Side, but it sounds a lot like war to me. we start killing people?
Well, the short answer is it's not.
Okay.
So, and historically, it hasn't been.
All right. Well,
by the way, I don't know if you noticed this, but the Indians and I think the Danes have been seizing boats out in the open ocean under the same international legal justification that we have, and boarding them and confiscating them. Just so you know. You asked me about you know, who else is doing that, and I said, well, I'm not sure.
Why are they doing it? Why would the Danes?
Because international law allows them to, and they have the capability to do so. They're seizing vessels that are improperly flagged.
Okay. All right. So
same justification we had.
Why does somebody in the open ocean even need to be flagged?
Because they're. You have concerns about piracy and international commerce, and you don't want ships that are misidentified, that the potential mischief that a boat that is improperly or not legally flagged to operate in international waters are pretty significant. They could be pirates, they could be international terrorists, they could be people evading tax authorities or law enforcement authorities or whatever. Short answer is, if you want to put a boat of a certain size out on the ocean, it's got to be flagged and it's got to be registered, and it has to let people know where it is so we don't have chaos. And if they don't
if every country doesn't let the thing land and do their nefarious deed, you can't offload a ship in the middle of the ocean, can you? Or is there a
you don't have to. I'm sorry, what are you asking about? There's all kinds of things other than offloading crude oil. That stuff, those vessels could be carrying anything, and that's why the requirement for flagging them and having them registered.
The requirement is from whom? Anybody who just happens to be strong enough, or what?
No, there's an international legal regimen that allows this, and it goes back to the 1600s.
If I want to go board your ship in the middle of the South Atlantic, is there somebody I have to go get approval from, or I just go do it?
No, you do it. You do it because you've got the capability to do it.
All right, we're right back into boy.
I'm just saying, you keep pointing at us because Trump is in charge. You keep pointing at us for doing the bad stuff, and I'm just telling you.
I said we're the only people that are bad.
This is international law.
Well, there's always seemingly going to be bad states in the world, and I hope we don't become one. I sure hope we don't become one. But at some point, the logic and when somebody else can go do something about it. I mean, we really don't care about the people that are demonstrating in Iran. I mean, does anybody really care about them? I mean, maybe you and I do, but I mean, does anybody really care about those people? I do on a humanitarian basis, but
well, I mean, I think to the extent that we. I think we look at this at some threshold level and say you can't have this. Now, it's problematic, and maybe we can do something about it. But that's not the reason we're going into Iran.
Well, who's worse than that than China? We can't wait to sell them chips because somebody's getting a cut out of them. The government's getting 20%, right?
I don't know the exact details of whatever that thing is, but I mean, we're not. As far as I know, China is not massacring. I mean, they've put over a million people in concentration camps, but they're not massacring people in the streets. But even if they were, I think while we might try to condemn it and try to push for sanctions against them, I don't think we'd bomb them.
No, I mean that's what I'm trying to find some kind of a. I'm arguing, Lou, to get more intelligence out of you because there's always more in there.
I don't think
so.
That's
true. I mean, that's why I banter with the guests. It's not like I disagree with them.
No, I understand.
I'm just saying.
I just want to understand what your question is. You're right. I don't. Well, I do think we care about the demonstrators in Iran, but that's not the reason we're setting up all this stuff.
Now, Iran is doing a lot of no good Nick stuff around the world for whatever reason. So is North Korea. Why is North Korea selling Iran missiles? When they can't even keep their electricity on, nobody has a pot to piss in. I mean, who said there was that Reagan named the rogue states? He wasn't wrong.
The axis of evil.
Yeah, he wasn't wrong. They're still the same guys. I mean, I don't know how you, you know.
But I mean, so, I'm sorry. So what is your question? Is your question why they haven't invaded North Korea?
There always seems to be, when you see some place like this going on, you could say, okay, 100 years from now, somehow or another, the people in Iran are going to find a way to get rid of these idiots, or they're going to die off, or they're going to become corrupt amongst themselves and self-destruct, which a lot of really bad governments have done. That's one possibility. We could just make sure they don't mess with anybody else. That's another possibility. We could do something even more so and say, well, we don't want them to have nuclear stuff, make sure they don't get that. All right, that's choice number three. Or we can decide we don't want them doing anything to anybody else, and we're just going to win and blast them because we want to blast them without any view of what's going to happen the next day, like we did in Iraq. Those are four choices, though. I just don't know how you figure out which one you pick is my question.
Well, and I'm excuse me, I'm of the opinion that what is happening with Iran right now is a long overdue adjustment that's been, as I said, been in the making for over 40 years. It should have been done. It should have been done decades ago, but it wasn't. Okay, that we're gonna try to deal with it now. A huge part of the reason we're electing to deal with it now is because the Israelis basically show that the Iranians are not the kind of, you know, regional superpower that we might have thought they were. In fact, the Israelis have pretty much showed that you can fly foreign fighters right over downtown Tehran in the middle of the daytime once you've demonstrated your capability. And so from our perspective, this is a good time to deal with this.
We're gonna go right in the face of Colin Powell. You break it, you own it.
That's a great line, but we're not going to break it. I don't think we're going to break it to that extent.
We're going to take care of get rid of their offensive capabilities. We're going to take out their government. How is this any different than Iraq?
Well, we're not putting boots on the ground. Yeah. And we're going to let whatever power structure there is. This is, again, Tom, I have to think that somebody at least somewhere has set up or has got an alternative to that theocracy, because if Iran's what, 90 million people?
Well, it's a huge place, and it's got nothing.
Yeah, it's big. It if we destabilize a country with 90 million people, do we end up with 30 million refugees streaming out of there into Turkey and Russia and Pakistan and God knows where else?
We certainly don't want one of them here, even though we don't want one of them here. No.
Well, I mean, what are we going to end up with? I don't know. Again, maybe if this kicks off, we get an articulate explanation of this is the end game. I think the end game is not necessarily to kill the Iranian leadership, but basically to destroy its capability, to terrorize its population internally, and then those guys leave.
Well,
we know that they were getting ready to. They've moved their family members out of the country.
Well, I hearken back to who was the guy, the consultant that was Rumsfeld's buddy that was going to be the new head of Iraq, and he got there and he barely got out with his skin alive.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah, that's the risk, and so that's I assume, excuse me, I assume part of the thought process that is churning away in Washington and Tel Aviv and Riyadh and a few other places. I'm reasonably certain we're talking to all those people and in Jordan and Egypt. I'm reasonably certain we're talking, and in Turkey, we're talking to all those people saying, look, this is what we want to do. Be prepared. We're prepared, but we do not want to uncork a situation where 90 million people try to get out of that country at one time.
Well, as long as they don't come here, who cares?
Well, but we care because the civil war in Syria and the unrest in the Middle East pumped, what, 50 million, 30 million people into Europe and with horrific results. And we don't want to see that again. And we don't want a monster destabilization that's going to cause Turkey or the Russians or the Armenians or Pakistanis to go nuts because they're losing control of their borders. And there's a bunch of dominoes that get pushed over with
exactly
something
right.
like this.
And
we don't, you know, I always think of this as a circle of dominoes extending out, you know, hundreds of yards. And we push over, you know, we're not just pushing over one domino. We push over four or five dominoes, and they run in different lines out away from the original point of contact. And we can't tell what dominoes are going to fall after about the third or fourth ones.
Well, can you think back in history with some countries, whether they were aggressive or not, had some, I'd say, pretty skilled leadership in some ways. Has anybody ever been able to, cry havoc and let loose the dogs of war? Does anybody honestly know where a war is going to go once you start it? Has it ever happened? I mean, I guess in World War II, because of the Allies, once everybody got together and said, okay, what are we going to do after Midway, after there was some sense that the Allies could actually win, there was serious coordination of what was going to happen afterward.
There's always, I'm sorry, Tom, there's always a plan. You know, this is where we think it's going to go. This is how we want to control it. This is the desired outcome. And you keep the desired outcome, you know, on your windshield all the time. But there is, between you and the desired outcome, things change constantly. And that, I mean, that's war. And it's not just war, it's the actual terms of the conflict, and then it's all the other stuff that's happening around the conflict. So, you know, let's just say we kick this thing off this weekend. At the same time, China says, well, the United States has got probably half of its early warning air assets in the Middle East. This would be a great weekend to invade Taiwan. While all of our stuff is pitched over, not all of it, but a significant amount of our stuff is pitched in the Middle East. Or the North Koreans say, well, you know, U.S.'s attention is diverted. This would be a great weekend to attack South Korea. Or some other stupid craziness. The Russians decide this would be a great weekend to attack Estonia because our attention's diverted. And NATO's just talking about writing checks. So we don't know.
What makes you think we have the let's say our man Ronald Reagan did the right thing. He essentially outspent and drained the crap out of Russia, right? And when we essentially won the Cold War. That's the mantra anyway. What makes you think, and I don't know if they're anywhere near coordinated to do it, that our quote enemies, China, North Korea, Russia, and whoever else you want to put in there, aren't doing the exact same thing to us to major success.
Yeah.
We're absolutely broke. There's no capability of fighting a two or three front war, and yet we jump gleefully at every opportunity to do something.
I'm sure China, now this is part of supposedly the game with China for, you know, decades, that they've been playing this long game to gradually weaken us, and that, you know, is that habit that may be coming to fruition now.
I don't see how we can put that much. I mean, I don't know what our capabilities are, but if somehow or another a couple of these aircraft carriers go down, which, God, I hope don't happen, we actually have some problems with some of this stuff. Where's our backup? You keep talking about that we don't have enough shells for cannons. We don't have enough this. We don't have that. Where are we on this stuff, other than being broke?
Well, I don't know if we're broke, but
well, we can borrow more. But what about the people we're borrowing from? All we do is insult.
Yeah. If we have to expend a tremendous amount of our magazine capability with air defense in this situation that's developing in the Middle East, I'm sure the Chinese will take careful note of it.
Because
that's where we really need it. And with that, I'm going to leave you because Aunt Wayne and Andrew have been standing by patiently as they always do. Gentlemen, I'm sorry.
It's a good discussion, Lou, because it opens up all kinds of different things. I mean, if we do we try and let the Iranians handle it themselves? It seems like maybe we should just support those people. We've done that before, right?
The Israelis, you mean?
No, the people that are in Iran.
Oh, the internal Iranians. Yeah, I mean I'm sure that's been war gamed out in some State Department boardroom.
We've been happy
with that.
Okay, but take care.
I'm going to leave you. There's
plenty of snow
out west. By the way,
how much snow did you guys get?
Depends where you are in the state, but most of the ski areas got somewhere between 8 to 15 inches.
So not enough to turn the winter around.
Oh no, we're not. We need what happened out in Lake Tahoe. We need like two or three of those. So,
okay.
All right, guys, all right, have a good weekend.
Wayne, Andrew, how are you guys?
Good morning.
Are they going to re-up Wayne? Is he going back? Is he being re-enlisted for the weekend's war?
Well, I hope I'm not. I'm already getting disability from the VA. I don't think I'd do much good being put back on active duty because I'd have a different goal in mind.
They give you a desk job somewhere.
Yeah, hopefully they give me a desk job right there in the National Security Council at the White House, and I could storm into the Oval Office and tell him to get the heck out of there.
You know, I don't. I sure hope that there are cool heads someplace, and I'm not saying there isn't. I don't see a whole lot of evidence of it from my end. I mean, the thing yesterday, I sent you guys. I think I did a couple of weeks ago. I forget the name of the outfit, the place that did the tariff study, and their conclusion was that the tariffs, 94% of them, are being paid by American citizens or people in this country.
Now, yeah.
And I, at the time, I try and be fair on this, even though a lot of people think I'm not, that I don't know that the how much they factored in somebody maybe lowering the price getting here to remain competitive. So even though the tariffs are being paid here, the final price isn't quite as high as that 94% number would account for. So I kind of poked a hole in the argument, you know, right there, as if that's something. In other words, what I'm trying to detail is Mercedes comes over here, the tariff is paid here by the importer. There's no way you can tell by that study whether Mercedes dropped the price from 50 grand to 48 to somewhat made a little bit competitive. So that's not in there. But the fact is, the tariffs themselves are being paid by people here. It's been predicted by anybody who's ever had any ounce of economics from day one, from Trump started doing this 8 years ago. There's no doubt they're paid here. Sorry, they are. You know, so then the same conclusion was reached by the Fed. Was it Bessent came out and said there needs to be discipline there because they shouldn't be writing papers like this? Are we talking about Goebbels here? What are we talking about?
I don't know. This guy Bessent, he reminds me of every bad character actor in a movie that you just are hoping does not have a very good outcome by the end of the movie. I mean, the guy just lies with this sort of you know the character actors. I mean, they've been in every movie since the beginning of, well, at least the talkies. I hope he gets it in the end.
Well, you know, my brothers, you may ever watch it's an old movie now, but a classic Western, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh, yeah.
Remember the guy that whenever Liberty said something, the guy behind him always laughed? My brother goes, that reminds him so much of this Bessent guy. His job was to, like, laugh and whenever anything Liberty said something sort of funny.
Do you remember the last words of that by the newspaper editor?
Vividly. But go ahead, Sam.
No, you do it. You're probably
what is it, if the facts conflict with the legend, print the legend?
Yeah.
How true is that, boy?
Oh, Most of the time, not the case, but in some very big situations, it's definitely the case.
What, you know, Lou's view of the Epstein stuff, and again, I'm on, this is on many different levels, and I talk to people, and I always ask, what do you make of this? And it's funny, the answer I get from wherever the individual people, depending on, I use the term, their walk of life, is always different. It's on a million different levels. If you talk to, not a million, but several, where somebody will say, anybody who can mess around with young girls like that, you know, should be shot or something. You know, I don't know about shouting or shooting them, but, you know, or somebody said, who's the money behind this stuff? You'll get from somebody on some other level. Or somebody else will say, are all rich people this creepy, and who protects them? I mean, there's all kinds of levels that people are picking out here that it makes me think it's sort of not going to go away too soon.
Well, there's one other level which Wayne and I encounter a fair amount from some surprising sources, but there's a reason for it. Is, well, I don't care about that. I know I've heard enough about it. I want to focus on other things. And so that's a huge factor, because there's a lot of people who feel that way. So we have a tension of your first three categories, and then other people saying, well, I just kind of like Trump, and this is all unfair, and what about... and then mention some other thing.
What about Biden? Yeah, what about Biden?
So we don't know, but Wayne has actually done quite a bit of writing this week about international reaction to it.
Including the breaking news that the pedophile formerly known as Prince is been arrested in England.
What were the charges? I read that he got arrested. What are they charging him with?
It doesn't sound like it's related to the core Epstein issue. What it sounds like is he's being investigated for providing confidential government information to Jeffrey Epstein. Interestingly, it's the same allegations being leveled against Peter Mandelson, the former British ambassador to the United States. Now, I'm not sure whether this is a workaround by the Brits, because they're saying, well, you know, he may have given classified information, but in return for what? Okay, I think that's where the British are going. Okay, you gave classified information, you, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, whatever his name is now, and you, Peter Mandelson, and maybe some... you gave that stuff to Epstein. Now, what did Epstein give you in return for this confidential classified information?
What would you guys guess?
And that's where they're going to get, and I think that's where they're going to get both of them.
Well, you guys are up the chain here in knowledge on this stuff compared to me. What level of classified information would Prince Andrew have been privy to?
He was involved with a lot of... on behalf of the British government, a lot of... make British, especially military exports, look good to potential clients around the world. So he would have been privy to, a lot of internal British government information on, which could be derived, of course, from the intelligence agencies themselves, on the Saudis, for example, and India. On military exports, and of course that would be that also would have been of interest to Epstein, because he was at least working for two foreign intelligence agencies, the Russians and once the Soviets, and also the Israelis.
Well, Andrew, from what you were just saying, people were... Before I'm done with Wayne, if he was here, would he be, you know, secret, top secret? What level would he be, you know, for your eyes only? I mean, I'm sure he knows all about the commerce back and forth with the military and stuff, but he wouldn't be privy to what, you know, like the British Admiralty's doing, would he? I mean...
No, it could be top secret, but it would be top secret based on all source intelligence, which could be things derived from British spies abroad, signals intelligence that would be from intercepts of private communications. That's a sort of he probably was given access to a compendium that takes all those things together and provides it, because I don't think Prince Andrew would be reading a lengthy government report. It would be basically a classified executive level white paper.
Yeah, because I know way less about the British system of government than probably I should, but I mean, the Queen was essentially above reproach. I still don't think she was in any cabinet meeting, if any cabinet meeting, about any kind of foreign policy or any kind of military movements or anything like that. And if she wasn't, I can't believe her kids were. I mean, I'm trying to figure out where they were exactly. Yeah. They land
well,
on this.
I think one of the ways it works is he might be kind of ex officio part of trade negotiations. And necessarily briefed on confidential secret stuff to help advance British trade. And since, as Wayne pointed out, a lot of this trade might involve military materials, then the world of contractors and other diplomats would like to get their hands on the basic information, not just what the trade delegation is talking about. And so Epstein and his circle of investors, they'd love to know this kind of information too.
I would also point out that the MI6 has a liaison officer permanently assigned to Buckingham Palace. The purpose of that is that the monarch can ask for, intelligence. And it goes into what's called a red box on the desk of the now King Charles. It's literally a red box. Now, the red box also is where bills that have been passed by Parliament go for what they call royal assent. But you can find a lot of stuff in the red box. Now, whether the pedophile formerly known as Prince was sneaking around Buckingham Palace and peeking into the red box, that's for conjecture.
Well, here's something that's solid that I know, at least, and maybe he said it on the show, but last fall, when Prince Andrew was stripped of his title and the Epstein files were still secret in the U.S., Wayne was saying repeatedly, at least to me, maybe on the show, I'll bet that British intelligence has found out stuff from the secret Epstein files about Prince Andrew, and as a courtesy, they're relaying what they've heard from U.S. intelligence to the British crown, that you've got to get this guy stripped of his titles.
They seem to be, to go back to what you mentioned earlier, Andrew, on some level of the Epstein stuff, and I mentioned this yesterday, maybe because of your friend Wayne, I'm a little, I won't say over, I'm not focusing so much on the people coming over here, because for whatever reason they need to mess with young girls. I don't even understand that, but I guess I sort of do. But I've kind of morphed away from that into the stuff that Wayne is talking about, and I'm zeroing in on, okay, what do they gain from these people? What information? Why was it so important that all these people that had power, our current Commerce Secretary, why he's not resigning, I have no idea. Why these guys are, were this guy held the key to something. What's the something? Was he the ground central for, Trump or whoever? Biden decides we're not going to have you can't write a check to Russia. And you call up Epstein and you go, okay, I got to get some money into Russia. I'm buying this crap. Does Epstein know the guy? Is that why? There's something way beyond here than messing around with the little girls. And that's the part I've focused in on.
Well, you're right. And it goes, it's before Epstein. Remember, Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father, he was running the same sort of operation. He was a major publisher in London, but he, you know, he lived in New York. He lived on a yacht for a while, parked right in New York Harbor. And so if you talk Robert Maxwell, and it looks like Robert Maxwell passed a lot of this on, or at least designated Epstein as his heir as far as this operation is concerned. It goes back to the end of World War II. And you look through, now they're looking at, you remember this character, Jimmy Savile, who was a BBC guy on like, he was their version of Dick Clark on American Bandstand.
Really?
A real creepy guy, but he was always invited. He was at the palace. He was at this thing and that thing. And now that people are looking back at that and saying, this was part of a blackmail extortion or sextortion, however you want to put it, operation. It went back and included probably other prime ministers of Britain, including Edward Heath, who was before Margaret Thatcher, who was strongly rumored to be involved with young boys. So it's young girls, young boys. It's anything you can use to hold a blackmail weapon over someone's head.
Read Denny Hastert.
Yeah. Somebody I'm fairly familiar with. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the idea that when you get in one of those areas, when everybody's out to get you, I often wonder what the government would be like differently if Elliot Spitzer would essentially kept his zipper zipped. I think he was probably one of the most brilliant men we've ever had in government. And he was a threat to these people we're talking about, wasn't he?
Yes. Yes.
But he couldn't, they had to be watching him like a hawk.
They're not just watching him. We think he was encouraged in his operation, his delinquency, his nefarious activities, because in his case, the woman was a professional escort, and what if some of the escorts, or more precisely their madams, start talking, they'll say they're for hire. And the fee for taking out the New York governor and former attorney general is probably a lot higher for the real paymaster than one night of sex.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm not exactly happy that it's kind of percolated up, but a lot of the conflict between left and right now is somewhere in the line. We just talked about it with Lou, and we have other people on the show, and these are we're talking about really bright people. Somewhere, someplace, there's a confidence, and I don't know that it's because they're all in on this group, or there's people in Chicago that are all in on the current mayor group. You know, people say I'm not in the middle. I sort of am in the middle. I didn't see in the Biden administration, two or three people in a room that I could count on to come up with the right, or at least an intelligent path forward. And I surely don't in this group, but there's people who, because they're their guys, assume that there must be these people. There has to be these people behind the scenes that are amazingly thoughtful, that there's all a plan for all this stuff, and all the other stuff is just politics. I don't see it. Now, I didn't see it with Biden. I didn't see it with this guy. I sure as hell didn't see it with Iraq One. I don't know if I saw it with Obama, to be honest with you. I mean, where is, you know, a George Marshall? Where are these people? Is anybody, are they really there, or are they all these guys just flying by the seat of their pants?
Well, I think there's a whole range of capabilities, but you were talking with Lou about Iraq, and I think the name you were thinking of was Paul Bremer, who was sent in to be.
I thought he was a native Iraqi.
No, the person Rumsfeld wanted was a guy named Ahmed Shalabi.
Yeah, that's right.
He was a mess. He was a crook.
And he was being paid as a consultant, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to just say about Bremer, he was kind of a technocrat who had a lot of managerial capabilities, but if the mission is almost impossible and the goals are unrealistic, a track record of some success in management or as a CEO is mismatched to an impossible goal, and so it was a disaster. But he probably had a lot more capabilities than many other people. So I think it varies with the situation. My point.
I just, when this stuff starts to happen, you really hope that when you start killing people, there's some overall plan. With all this stuff going on in Washington and arrows are flying at this guy, I'm not so sure where I would say he would stop at causing a diversion. I sure as hell hope it's not starting a war.
Well, again, if you have an almost impossible situation, it's going to be hard to find a situation. In fact, Wayne's got a story, I don't know if it's that relevant, but it might be, of being invited by Iran's government, in effect, to attend some conference in Iran, and partway through it, they're talking about, well, Wayne, wouldn't you like to go and explore the back country? And Wayne's thinking, I'm not sure I want to get in the jeep to the back country here.
I wasn't quite sure I wanted to be in the in where I was in Tehran after a couple of nefarious nabobs over there approached me, probably working for Iranian intelligence.
Yeah, so even if you think you know what you're doing up to a point, the situation can change and make you think, I was on a
delegation, and the guy, it turned out that the guy who basically said, hey, you want to watch out for that guy and that guy, that, you know, I think they're with intelligence, he was actually a Church of England vicar, member of the delegation, but he seemed to be so steeped in the world of counter espionage, I think he was he may have been a bit more than a vicar, you know.
You've actually been to Tehran?
Yeah, I was there in 2014.
What is Tehran? It's supposed to be huge, isn't it?
It's huge. It's I mean, first of all, I actually was also in the south near well, I landed in Shiraz driven pretty 125 kilometers from the Persian Gulf. But it's a huge, Tehran's huge. It reminds me somewhat of with the hills and mountains around it. It's a little bit like L.A., which is interesting because a lot of Iranian expats actually moved out to Southern California, and the weather is similar. I was there during a dust storm, which looks like you're getting a big thunderstorm rolling in. Yeah. That ain't fun. Dust storm.
Is Tehran like on a navigable body of water, or why is Tehran where?
No, it's pretty well, it's landlocked. I think there's a maybe a river or two that pass through the capital, but it's you know, we saw most of the city. I mean, they've got like interstate highways, you know, freeways through Tehran, and you know, tall buildings, the people on the, you know, the people were very friendly. I got the distinct impression that if it wasn't for the mullahs and ayatollahs and the rest of them, that they you know, would probably want to be good friends of the United States. But there's that other problem. I also went to the former U.S. embassy, which is now a museum, where they stormed it, and they had actually, it looks like a picture frozen in time. I was in the military, in the Navy, back in that time frame, and they have all the communications equipment, all the encryption equipment. It's I said to him, I said, this looks like the places I used to work, which was interesting.
And well, you know, we're going to break here in a minute, but it seems when I was asking Lou about different ways to go about whatever it is we're trying to do. And I, you know, one of them, I've known several people from Iran. Every one of them has advanced degrees. Every one of them is, to me, is about as American as pizza pie, for God's sake. And I don't know how they got here. Didn't want to ask, but they've been here for a long time. They all have families and that kind of thing. And they must have come out when they shot it. We must have let a lot of those people in, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
And every one of them says to me, you know, like 90% of the population can't stand these people.
Mm-hmm.
And if they could find any way, you know, maybe it's one argument for people having guns, I don't know. But if there's any way to get them out of there, they sure as hell would. And so the idea that, you know, I don't know how that is formatted. I don't know how you can arm a population. I don't know if any of those people are organized. But clearly it's kind of a powder keg inside. And I don't know how long, whether it's a 10-year plan or 100-year plan or whatever, but the revolution, or let's say the disdain for the group seems higher than most places, you know, that they have a bad government. You know, I don't know if we have any boots on the ground there, but I don't know if I would want to be an agent on the ground in Iran. But it seems like a very, very complicated situation where most of the people agree with you.
Yeah,
well, it is, but... And I know we're going to break here, but I'll just plant a thought. In the early 1950s, the men dressed in suit and ties, a lot of them, it was secular, and then we toppled the government in 1954, and it was the best minds in the U.S. security establishment said, well, let's overthrow the government, because
what was the government? Was it a monarchy? What was it?
It was a prime minister, democratically elected, Mossadegh.
Really?
And yeah. he was talking about nationalizing the oil companies, and the Brits and the U.S. said, well, we can't have that. We overthrew the government, installed the Shah, and that led to the 1970s takeover by the radical Islamists. And so these experiments have a way of going bad.
Well, there's a book my buddy John Lee gave me, and I mean, we can talk about, you know, and we have people now, and it's all about our national interests, and we got to mess with these guys. You look at the whole history of the Middle East, the day the Brit found oil in Iran, everybody's been up to their ass in this place, the U.S., the Brits, because of oil. Everything we did was because of oil. I mean, I don't think we invaded Iraq because Rummy and Cheney knew buddies that wanted the oil. You got to go read a book somewhere. I mean, it's all about oil. It's always
of course.
Been. It always has been.
And that's, you know, right.
Anyway, S&P futures down 24, and NASDAQ futures down 125. You're right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues.
The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Listen, are you a 50-year-old person looking for term life insurance? Then you need to talk to Bob. Bob specializes in helping people find $1 million or more of term life insurance for a couple of $100 a month. Look, you need to know there's a price war in the term life insurance business, and you may be paying too much. Call Bob, and he'll shop and see how much money he can save you. Look, this could be the last term life insurance policy you ever have. Your rates are guaranteed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rates for the next 20 years. And if you're a smoker or your health is not perfect, Bob has great rates for you too. So for $1 million of term life insurance coverage for a couple of $100 a month, call Bob right now. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. That's 800-989-1415. Paid for by Term Direct.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Smell! You know that gasoline smell? Smells like victory.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. We're back.
Blowing up big stocks and jocks. S&P futures down 22. NASDAQ futures down 112. We'll buzz through this pretty quick because we have our guys. And I got a million questions. DAX down 238, it's a full 1%. First time those guys have been down a bit. FTSE down 69.6%. CAC round down 69.8%. So European stocks are kind of lower across the board. Not crazy, but reasonable move. Nikkei up 323. Now they're trading 0.6%. Hang Seng, they are they're not trading. Last was 216 because of the Chinese New Year, and of course the Chinese have not been trading, so they got like a week off with the. I think it's the year of the horse. I don't know if anybody's a horse that's on the show today, but I'm sure. Jimmy, are you a horse? What are you?
No, I'm not a horse. I think I'm a snake.
You're what?
A snake. It's done by year.
Yes. No comment. Bonds up 1 basis point, 2.75. That's the bond, sorry. Ours up 2 basis points, 4.10. We've been in these low fours for really quite a while. The bond market's been very stable. Gold down $3. They made a big rally yesterday after a big sell-off. Slightly above 5,000, 5,006. Silver up 31 cents, 77.91. Oil, $1.24. Has broken out of this last range. Now 66.43, and a lot of this, I'm sure, is because Lou's been talking about it. And if you ask yourself, okay, if Iran goes off the reservation in terms of being able to export oil to anybody, if oil goes to $100, God, who wins on that? There'd be a list of people. Brent up $1, 71.53. Foreign exchange, 117.61. The dollar, well, the pound made it up to 118. Now it's 117.6. I'm sorry, that's the euro. The pound is 134.6, so kind of steady. Crypto down $71, 66.250. So it's been kind of steady lately after going flying way up, flying way down, and coming back. Jimmy, Air Force, Trevi, Weather Sports.
Okay, on the inbound, Kennedy from Montrose, it's 26 minutes. The inbound Edens from Lake Cook is 40 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf to I-90 is 42. And the inbound Dan Ryan from 95th to the I to 290 is at 28. In weather, we have a high of 44 degrees in Phoenix with a high of 64. In Chicago, it looks like we are going to we're at 46 degrees, but we are going to have showers. And then a cold front coming in. And obviously in sports, it's the Olympics. Mikhail Shefferin did win the gold medal in the women's slalom. the U.S. and the Canadians both advanced in men's hockey in overtime. And that's about it. Back to you.
What do you suppose would have happened if both the U.S. and Canada would have lost for ratings?
That would have been tough because the three countries that are made up of all pros are Sweden, Canada, and the United States. Now, Finland has most of their team is pros. You carry 25 people. The Finns have 20 pros on their team.
Really?
The Czechoslovakians have 18. The Slovakians have like 19.
That's unbelievable.
Well, you look at who the pros are, yeah. They take a 2 week off, so a lot of these teams are loaded with pros.
Only one Blackhawk made it, the guy playing for Finland.
That is correct.
Teravainen. Anyway, guys, we've got enough topics here. Hey, I have to ask you one question. This fiasco with this Canadian bridge, yet another, I don't know, unforced error by this guy. his buddy owns the how does a person own the Ambassador Bridge? For what I'm talking about here, the new bridge is paid for by Canada and I guess some by Michigan. Trump has threatened to not open it because he's mad at Canada, but in fact, now there seems to be documentation, I've heard it about five different places, not just CNN, that the Commerce Secretary, the guy who was visited Epstein Island, had a conversation with a guy who evidently owns the Ambassador Bridge, the other bridge. Now, there's the Ambassador Bridge and there's a tunnel. Now, there's just going to be this new bridge. Well, evidently, the toll on the Ambassador Bridge goes to one guy. How does a guy own the bridge?
Yeah, I mean it's we do know there are some privately owned highways, freeways, whatever, not freeways, but anymore. For example, in the D.C. area, where I'm actually present at the moment, there was an extension built out by Dulles Airport. Hopefully, will not be renamed Trump Airport, and it was done with private funds. So the tolls go to a private company.
Well, here are the
cities.
Well,
also on the Mexican border. And I'm not an expert on it, but a close friend of mine had a close friend who owned a bridge across the River Grande, Rio Grande. I think it was near McAllen, Texas. And so the concept of privatization of roads is attractive in some libertarian circles as a way to avoid outright taxing through the government, and you give a concession to private people, and of course they tax the users.
Well, the Chicago School sold a Skyway, they sold a Millennium Park, and they sold parking, and they sold the parking meter. So, but I guess my naivety here is that somehow when the Ambassador Bridge was built, it was somewhat of a cooperative effort between us and Canada. And maybe somebody says, I'll give somebody, $10 billion for the place, and I'll own it, and you guys get the $10 billion.
Yeah.
But I suppose that kind of what happened. But it seems like if both of us owned it, that'd be one hell of a negotiation, wouldn't it?
Sure. And Trump is upset because the other bridge is called the Gordie Howe Bridge.
Yeah.
I guess Trump was beating Carney over the head, saying, "Hey, we helped with that," and he said, "No, you didn't. And most of it was built with Canadian government funding, with a little bit from, as you said, Michigan." And Trump really has no say in the matter. But I wouldn't be surprised if he says, "Look, I want to own half of it," and it goes into my bank account in Qatar with the with the money from the seized Venezuelan oil.
Yeah, it's a back to this kind of my rant. To me, it seems like all these things are amazingly ticklish. But I mean, when you broke up Iraq, you had three different groups that lived there that didn't really like each other. And the fact that they had this, you know, kind of goofball dictator who nobody liked, including me, sort of held the place together. So breaking that apart had its own can of worms. Iran, I keep thinking, I don't know, every year I keep thinking that somehow or another they're going to, the Iranians are going to find a way to get these people out of there, but they never seem to be able to. Now,
well, they're not all ethnic Iranians in Iran either. And you've got a Kurdish area in the north west. You've got Azerbaijanis in the north, and they would like to join Azerbaijani independent country of Azerbaijan. There's Arabs in the south near where the oil, actually where the oil is drilled, and they don't want to be part of a Shia non-Arab country. They, you know, rather maybe be part of Iraq. And then you got the Baluchis over by Pakistan. They want to be their own country. You've got the Turkmen up in the northeast of Iran, and you know they'd like to be part of Turkmenistan. And so this is not an easy. It's like Iraq. It could fracture apart. The other thing is the opposition in Iran. You got to be careful. We got to be careful who we back, because the Shah's son would like to go back there, and he leads a group, but he spends most of his time in expensive hotels in the West. He lives, he actually has a house in Potomac, Maryland, which is pretty ritzy. Nobody really wants the Shah back, especially this guy. And there's also the group called the MEK, which we supported, and then they were in Iraq helping against Saddam. And the MEK used to be Marxists who opposed the Shah, and they were terrorists, and they killed American citizens when we had military and diplomats in Iran. And now they've said, "Oh no, we want to be the new Iranian government," but it's basically become a religious cult in service to the woman that runs it.
Is that a Muslim cult or something? What other kind of religion are we talking? Or is it Muslim?
It's not even that. They're ostensibly Muslim, but it was the MEK was founded by two, a husband and a wife. The husband died. The wife now leads the group, and it's more like of a cult. It's a cult of personality around her, When Saddam fell, we had to get the MEK. We used the MEK on the Iranian-Iraqi border, and Saddam was using them against the present Iranian government. And we had to find a place. Well, where do we put these people? We put them in Albania, and that's where they are. And this is a group like many exile groups we support have supported, like you know some of the Cuban terrorists that found homes in Florida. These are a bunch of bad. These are bad hombres.
We list some as terrorists until a terrorist organization until recently, and then people said, "Yeah, but you're working with them." What? Did I get that right?
No, they used to have an office in the National Press Building, and I remember when it must have been under Obama, they put the seal on it. They came around and closed it down, said it was their assets were frozen and stuff like that.
Are they ethnic Iranians, or where are they from?
Yeah, they're ethnic Iranians, but they used to be this really left-wing violent group that then basically they were chameleons. And now they've become this sort of member of the wider opposition to the present government over there. But they're nobody you really want to talk to.
Does anybody have a real job, or everybody's... You know, what is the, if you go into Iran, what is the unemployment rate? What is... Is the currency any good? Does the buses work? I mean, how do
everything works? They have a metro, a subway system there. I didn't get it. I didn't have a chance to ride on it, but yeah, everything works. The currency seems to be okay. The funny thing is, because of the American sanctions, you've got a lot of knockoff, like fast food places, places that look like Colonel Sanders but aren't quite Colonel Sanders, places that look like McDonald's but aren't quite McDonald's. So you've got a lot of that. Apparently, that's the case in Russia now, too, with the sanctions.
Well, they're not supposed to be able to implement. Do they? I guess the question is, can Iran feed itself? I mean, do they have...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the restaurants are full of people. I was in many.
I'm saying, is there enough agriculture? Is enough...
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, we're not talking Saudi Arabia, where the whole thing's a desert.
No. Oh, no. It's a diverse country. As a matter of fact, you go to the... If I was there longer, I would have liked to have gone up to the Caspian Sea. You have to cross some mountains that are alpine. That's the climate. And that's why you have Iran and they field a skiing team because they actually have ski slopes in Iran.
Really?
Yeah, up in the north, in the mountains.
So they were talking about, speaking of which, they were talking about the countries that pay more for medals than the U.S. One of them is like Singapore. Of course, they've never won a medal. So I was thinking of putting out a $5 million prize for anybody on Stocks and Jacks that won a gold medal. So Andrew will be out there working on his curling craft tomorrow to get the five.
Yeah, now. No, that, the curling. Curling is it, yeah.
You know, that's one of the highest rated things on. People love watching that.
Now, if the Summer Olympics would have like 12-ounce curls, lifting tankers of beer, I think.
Well, they should have 16-inch softball, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
I mean, why not? I mean, it should be. Bowling, bocce ball, I mean, those are real sports. I wonder how close bowling ever got to being in the Olympics. It was like the biggest sport in America for a while.
I thought there was talk of it getting into the Olympics.
Well, everything's kind of in there. I can't believe how many skiing things there are now. Where all, you know, between the snowboards, between the different aerial skiing and all. There used to be, slalom, giant slalom, and downhill, and skiing was over. There's all the bump skiing. It's pretty amazing. Have you ever been to that place up in Cortina? That looks like one hell of a nice spot in Italy where they're doing all the skiing stuff.
No, I've not been there.
Andrew, were you ever a skier?
I was, and somewhat late in my 20s, and I thought it was a I'd thought it was a sport for snobs, and then I realized, no, it's people who like to get out and live. And I traveled around. In fact, I went to a place in Portillo, Chile. I got a great deal there. And one of the attractions was, it was so steep that they set the world speed record there. And I managed to set the world speed record for falling on my butt. But to each his own, I guess.
We used to go every year out to Colorado, at least once or twice. It was a big deal. You go out for a week, and, you know, it was a lot of fun. I mean, go to a nice group of people, sometimes two cars, and I love Steamboat. We've been to all those places. Never been to Aspen. I've been to Jackson Hole, been to Grand Targhee, Steamboat, Telluride, Vail. I mean, nice spots. I mean, it's a... You know, if you don't have to be really good at it, if you get to the point where you can at least be somewhat comfortable, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Do you still ski?
Oh God, no! I haven't skied in a long time. I mean, I probably could give it a shot. I went maybe 15 years ago, and I found out that my window between warmed up and worn out was pretty narrow.
Well, that's what the fireplace of the ski lounge is for.
Well, you know what's even more the difference. We talk about technology. When you were younger and in really good shape, you'd ski down a nice big long run. You'd get in a lift line, which is a little bit of a bit, and it took a while for the lift, to get back up top. So if you could do 10, 12, 13, 14,000 feet of vertical in a day. When I was back then, I was in really good shape. I mean, you know, that was a pretty good day. They get these high speed lifts. I went out there and there was like, you know, not anybody really on the slopes. You're down to the bottom. You don't even have, you know, you haven't caught your breath yet. You're back up on this damn thing and it gets you to the top and like nothing flat. You can do 10,000 feet of vertical in like an hour and a half or two if you want to. I mean, that's a lot of skiing. I mean, I sit there and go, wait a minute, why am I tired? Well, because I just skied a whole day's worth and it's not even 11 o'clock. I mean, even if you're in good shape, like a half a day, if you're going at it, it's a long day. I mean, it really made a huge difference, the technology and how many people they can get up and down those mountains.
But now, well, it could also lead to injuries.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking about basketball, how many stars got hurt late last year in the season. You know, Jason Tatum, the Pacers, Halliburton, Kyrie Irving. And with skiing, I can imagine that, particularly as the body gets older and you overdo it, that's a lot of pressure on some of the joints that may not end well.
Well, and also you have to kind of use your head a little bit. As monkeys say, use your noodle. You can't, when you're going to be tired, like if it's 2:30 or something, you don't want to be tired on top of the mountain with 3,000 feet to go to get to the bottom.
Exactly, particularly if it ices up, gets cold again, and you're not doing powder, you're doing ice.
Yeah, but it's, you know, you're talking, it's very rare to even find powder. I mean, everybody talks about it, but I skied for years before I finally found it. I mean, it's a totally different brand of skiing. It's way harder. If you don't get the hang of that, boy. Plus, you fall down and you can't get up, which makes it even harder. In regards to this weekend, do you think we're going to have a war?
I would never bet against Trump doing this just to get him, you know, get the attention off the Epstein case. We've seen presidents carry out operations before that were questionable during a scandal like this, and much less of a scandal than this. I remember when Bill Clinton fired off cruise missiles and hit Afghanistan at the height of the Lewinsky thing. And, you know, and I was one of those who said, oh, come on, he did that. He did that to get, you know, get the attention off of Lewinsky. I'm not saying, you know, I think the Lewinsky thing was ridiculous, and it was, but nevertheless, we used some very expensive cruise missiles to get to hit Afghanistan during the height of that scandal. So it could, I'm thinking it could be the same situation here.
Well, what in regards to the Epstein, it seems like on one hand, people wanted to fall apart, I mean, or get bit in the back burner. Yet every day somebody kind of picks something up, and every day they let a couple of congressmen go over and look at the thing for 2 hours, and every time they come out with is a story.
Yeah, it's the files are immense, and I believe that some of the files may have to do with collateral investigations. Yes, Epstein is the core, but there are other aspects to this. Look, this guy Les Wexner supposedly testified. It was yesterday, day before, and the Republicans apparently didn't even participate in it. I think he did it by video. Do you know? I forget, Andy. Was it a video thing? Video?
Yeah, and I think it was from Ohio.
Yeah,
and we're still seeing dimensions of this unfold. And why they're unfolding. So let me give a quick example that's kind of in the news that I personally encountered. So last September, I think, the victims really had their first kind of organized demonstration calling for the release, and it was at a couple press conferences at the Capitol. And this Kentucky Republican Congressman Thomas Massie was one of the leaders of it, and of calling for the release of the documents. And because he was really the only Republican who was up front on it. He became kind of famous as kind of a fighter for public knowledge here. And I, after things thinned out and pretty much everybody left, I had a chance to talk with him. And I asked him about Les Wexner and Ohio State. And Wexner, of course, was kind of a financier and colleague and mentor of Epsing.
He's the guy that owns Gap, right?
Victoria's Secret and yeah, a bunch of
the Gap, the Limited. Yeah. And he's from Ohio, and he inherited this family business. And he's deeply implicated in all of this, as Wayne and I and some other people follow this know. Because, remember, we're talking about a world of beauty contests and models, and he had the stores, and they need models, and Epstein at one point was living in Columbus, Ohio, and he's deeply, deeply involved. And I asked Congressman Massey about it, and he said, oh, I went through the airport in Columbus, Ohio a couple times, and I thought, is that all he knows about this? And I wondered about it, but here's my main point, I guess, is I'm reading how he got involved in this, and it was because his wife encouraged him to, and he just asked a question at a nice Republican dinner of Pam Bondi last spring. And so he wasn't some big knowledgeable militant about it. And he ran the question by Jim Jordan, the Ohio congressman on the Judiciary Committee, can I ask this question? And he didn't start out as a big crusader. He just asked a question of Bondi, gee, if you've read all the files, why don't you release them? And that's led to all of this stuff in less than a year.
Well, what, you know, as I've kind of morphed into where, well, you guys and Wayne's writing about it, all the real intrigue, the people, who's got this goods on this guy, who's got, you know, why does the Goldman Sachs general counsel female have to, and she was an Obama lady, right? How does she end up being a big buddy Epstein?
I don't think it matters. As a matter of fact, I've never seen the movie in its entirety, maybe clips. The Stanley Kubrick's last film, Eyes Wide Shut, which now people are saying, look, Kubrick was trying to send a message that this sort of group does exist. And he did it, as many people have to do, through a fictional account, because it do a non-fictional account, you know, could be real problems. And of course, there's some suspicions about him dying right after the premiere of the movie in London.
At a young age, relatively young age.
Well, I guess my question is, if all, as you've alluded to, Wayne, there's CIA's involved, the Mossad, and people are grabbing, somebody is grabbing a lot of, you know, I'll say dope on a lot of people. Where is the Rolodex? Who has it? I mean, we talk a lot of, like, on Stocks and Jacks, a lot of stuff we talk about kind of connects with other stuff. I mean, we talked, you know, a while back, and I'm not going to go through it again, but why certain companies, you know, give judges money for elections. You know, in Illinois, State Farm has supported a lot of people running for judge and appeals and so forth. Now, is it done just on the one day, like The Godfather? I'm going to ask you for a favor. If somebody shows up, if Andrew shows up and somehow or another, you know, gets trashed on good booze down at Epstein's Island and somehow finds him in a room with a 15-year-old, and does somebody let him know that they got the goods on him, they got him on film,
Epstein was filming people, and to go to one of your points, it's not just a Rolodex, and it's not just who was on a plane or who was on the island. That's a vastly simplified and understandably so concept of what the files are. And why it's not going away is because it's much more complicated. It's now being crowdsourced all over the world. And I'll just give you a quick example because we're out of time here. But a reporter, Wayne and I know, sees a reference to Epstein flying into Waterbury, Connecticut. And it doesn't really have any details. And this reporter knows enough and knows enough to call us about, oh, Epstein flew to Waterbury, Connecticut. And he's exploring what the ramifications are of that, that nobody in the world could imagine, but they're potentially very, very serious in ways we don't have time for, and it's still ongoing. But that's what the files are about, is clues that people around the world say, oh my gosh, here's a fact that could lead to enormous other facts and implications, and ultimately money, not just sex.
Well, I'm saying, I guess my question is, maybe the final one is, if there is a, I won't call it a Rolodex, but a depository of, let's say, Joe Goofball was someplace, Manhattan, Florida, down there.
Maybe, well, it's maybe millions of pages of emails and photos and videos.
No, I'm talking about not the stuff that's in the emails and everything. I'm guessing that the real strong box, where if somebody's at the New Mexico house and they were there with a 14-year-old for 9 hours, that film, that's something, is not going to be in the email stuff. My question is, who's got it and where is it?
The DOJ has it, because the DOJ went in to Epstein's places, including the one in Manhattan where he did a lot of filming, and others. They've got the videos, and we've heard them say, well, we can't release those because they have to do with murder and all kinds of other heinous activities.
Even you are the man who knows all this stuff. You're sort of making the assumption that he didn't film the Arab people for the Mossad, and the Mossad has it, and he doesn't even have it anymore.
No. Well, I'm sure the Russians may have it, and the Israelis may have it, but also DOJ has it because they've got the originals.
Well, they've got the stuff that was found in Epstein's place. And I guess my question is, why do we know that it isn't some other place?
Oh, we don't know that. And I would assume that part of Epstein's deals was to provide it to his paymasters.
Through the
decades. I mean,
One former Israeli prime minister, maybe two, are subject to some of these videos too. So there could have been a case of, you blackmail me, I blackmail. Yeah, I mean, it's an unbelievable situation. And I got to say, I've covered a lot of conspiracies in the past to the point I'm accused of being a conspiracy theorist. But this one is this one's mind-boggling.
Robert
Maxwell handed off a decades-long operation to his daughter and Epstein, then we're not just talking about the Epstein era beginning in the mid-'80s. We're going back.
Whatever happened to all that guy's stuff?
Epstein would have inherited that as part of the deal.
Wow.
You know, Epstein got the Maxwell stuff. He even got Maxwell's daughter, Ghislaine.
Oh, God. Well, guys, we'll talk next week. Let's hope there's not a war going on. S&P futures down 25. NASDAQ futures down 118. Again, oil's up, like there might be something going on. You guys have a good weekend. You're here together. Now, don't close every bar, for God's sake.
We'll try not to.
You see the Italian lady who won the giant slalom, she won the Super G in the giant slalom. After she won the Super G, they said she was at every bar in Cortina and closed them. Good for her.
What's her name?
Oh, God, some Italian name. But she'd be a handful, let's put it that way. Terrific lady. She's the one who had the horrible break in her leg like a year ago.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Anyway, S&P futures down 25. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
Hear ye, hear ye. The Homer Broadcasting System is on the air.
This is Bob Uecker saying thanks for watching.